Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Vice Chancellor here at LSE, and I'm happy to welcome everybody here to this evening's very special program, both the live audience and those of you who are joining us. I don't know where to look for that, but those of you who are joining us online. So democracy is a kind of tricky beast. In the most fundamental sense, it means public officials who govern by the consent of the people of the nation or state. Historically, that was understood to be achieved through a whole wide range of devices. In the 18th and early 19th centuries, in both the United States and England, and actually continental Europe as well, critical means included not just the right to petition, although that was a very central right in thinking about what justified and created democratic government. That's why it's part of the First Amendment in the U.S. Constitution, but also a range of in-the-street activities, including parades, toasts at public feasts, and crowd action of various sorts that operate under well-understood customary rules. In that world, the right to vote was just one of many devices and actually not necessarily thought to be the most important one. Over time, our understanding of what it means to be a democracy evolved. So informal practices remain part of real democratic culture, but they're no longer seen as especially meaningful from a normative perspective. And we focus increasingly not just on government's responsiveness, but on the right and power of people to choose their leaders, which is to say, to remove leaders they no longer want or trust and replace them with others. As that happened, voting became the sine qua non of democracy. Still not the only requirement to be a proper democracy, but the foundational and fundamental practice denoting a genuinely democratic system. Now, you might think that it's a relatively simple matter to set up a system to elect political leaders, but it's not. Setting up a voting system that yields results that are both accurate and trustworthy turns out to be fraught with obstacles and complexity. Some of those are inherent in the system itself, just any system like that at scale. Others have been deliberately constructed for self-interested or nefarious reasons. And those difficulties have only grown over time as political actors figured out increasingly sophisticated ways to game the system, whether through registration requirements, the structure of voting, the structure of reporting on voting, districting, and so on. So this evening we'll dig into these issues while learning about LSE's Vote Democracy Project, which is a new global education initiative featuring a comprehensive course on the central role of voting in democracy. The evening will begin with a brief introduction to Vote Democracy by co-founder Rudolf Farah, over here, together with a short video about the project. That'll be followed by talks from Nobel laureates Professor Amartya Sen and Professor Eric Maskin, who are joining us online. Each will offer some thoughts and challenges related to core democratic principles. We'll then hear brief responses from Dr. Suzanne Blocks and Professor Richard Bradley. Both are here with us in person. They'll join us on stage. And after their remarks, we'll have time for questions from the audience. A couple of quick housekeeping matters. Our online audience can submit questions via the Q&A feature at the bottom of the screen. Questions will be screened by Kangyu Wang from the LSE Philosophy Department. Please let us know your name and affiliation when you put your question in there. We're particularly keen to hear from students and alumni. For those of you who are here in the theater, when we get to the Q&A period, raise your hand. I'll call on you. And also, when you stand, kindly give your name and affiliation before posing one. Try to keep it short. Question. I'll try to ensure that a range of questions are brought out both from our online audience and from the audience here in the theater. For social media users, following the conversation, the hashtags for today's event are hashtag LSE events and hashtag LSE philosophy. The event is being recorded and will hopefully be made available as a podcast. Okay, so with that housekeeping out of the way, let me introduce Rudolf Farah, co-founder and project leader of Voting Power and Procedures and director of its Vote Democracy Project. After the short video he'll introduce, we'll go directly into the talks by Professors Maskin and Sen, followed by brief reflections from our two panel discussants, and then we'll open the floor for questions. So Rudy, do you want to come on up here?
Well, good evening, everyone. The other day, someone who's seen publicity for this lecture, asked me if Vote Democracy was a new political party. I explained that it was an educational project and that the central on the central importance of voting in a democracy. Pity, she said. We desperately need a party focused on reforming the system. I said educating the future teachers, policymakers, and anyone interested was an important prerequisite. Her emphasis on reform reminded me of a public lecture that I chaired in January 2010, right here on this stage, featuring Sir Vince Cable, now professor here at the LSE, then deputy leader of the Liberal Democrats. And the lecture was electoral reform in the wake of the economic crisis. And it came during the aftermath of the 2008 financial crash. We discussed the Liberal Democrats' long-standing commitment to electoral reform, specifically challenging the plurality voting, commonly known as first-past-the-post in this country, to proportional representation. The Liberal Democrats' support for PR dates back as far as 1922 and even gained support from Winston Churchill, who was a Liberal from 1904 to 1924. In 1931, Churchill, then a Conservative again, he'd crossed the line, wrote, having to choose between the alternative vote, the second ballot, and proportional representation, I have no doubt that the last is incomparably the fairest, most scientific, and on the whole, the best in the public interest. In the same year, the UK elected a national government, a coalition of Conservatives, Liberals, and a few Labour MPs. Ramsay MacDonald was actually the Prime Minister, although he had the minority number of MPs in the national government. And this was the first and only government ever elected in the UK under first-past-the-post with a popular majority. It won 67% of the votes cast. Today, ruling parties elected typically receive around 35 to 40% of the popular vote. Sir Keir Starmer, who recently won a landslide 172-seat majority with less than 34% of the popular vote. Shortly after the public lecture here with Vince Cable, the Liberal Democrats joined a coalition with the Conservatives, conditional on a referendum to change the electoral system. Although the Liberal Democrats wanted to have a PR system, that was not agreed. But they found agreement with the alternative vote, and that was held in the following year, 2011. The AV referendum drive took the polarizing style of a political campaign focused on persuasive rather than the education of a totally uninformed public. And the debate became really quite bitter and divisive. First Past the Post, on the other hand, was praised for providing Labour MPs strong and stable government, a mantra that was going to be repeated endlessly, despite the coalition government holding the referendum in the first place, being a product of First Past the Post. The irony in that. The Conservative-led No to AV campaign, supported by over 200 Labour MPs, significantly outspent the pro-AV side, securing a decisive victory with 68% of the vote on a 42% turnout. Now, the point of the story and Vote Democracy's key objective is not in the support of any voting system or party, but to emphasize that education must precede any serious reform or change. Citizens must understand the systems they're voting on to make informed decisions. That's the case here or anywhere internationally throughout the world, United States in particular. Beyond electoral reform, another urgent concern is the global decline of democracy since the early 2000s, and especially post-2016. Authoritarian leaders and populist movements have challenged democratic systems, even in the most advanced democracies. Ignorance can be artfully exploited by demagogues, which is why Vote Democracy believes that education is democracy's best defense. Let's be very clear. Voting in free and fair elections is only one part of a functioning democracy. Liberty, equality, the rule of law, freedom of speech to discuss, deliberate, and freedom of assembly are all vital. However, without voting, representative democracy cannot exist. I'm leaving sortition and lotteries out of this for the moment, although the course does actually cover it. Vote Democracy is developing the first comprehensive undergraduate course on voting systems from the perspective of social choice and voting theory. The course will also have broader outreach, making it accessible both to academic and non-academic audiences. A forthcoming course book to be published by Springer and an accompanying video series will provide a modular structure adaptable to semester-long or a year-long course or for self-paced study. The course explores the history of voting theory, reviews the development of modern social choice from welfare economics, and analyzes issues like representation, majority rule, PR, gerrymandering, coalition governments, voting power, and voting paradoxes. It also covers experiments examining voter behavior and introduces the new area of computational social choice. Though voting theory is often called the mathematics of democracy, Vote Democracy minimizes formalism, particularly in its introductory modules. The video series, developed in collaboration with the LSE Department of Philosophy, will feature non-technical presentations that break down often complex topics into more accessible units. What makes the video production unique is its innovative by students, for students approach. Students write and present the video content, making it more relatable and engaging for the learners. This method can often capture enthusiasm and insights of presenters who have recently tackled the problems themselves. When funding or sponsorship is secured, the new Vote Democracy course will be made available worldwide to download free on open access. Voter education is one of the most pressing challenges of our time. Any movement to reform or sustain democracy must begin with an informed electorate. By empowering citizens through education, we can help to safeguard the future of democracy. Thanks. Now we play the clip.
In this presentation, I will be giving a brief personal overview of what I feel are the most important and interesting ideas in the Vote Democracy module, Electoral Systems, Party Systems, and Government Election by Nicholas Miller. Now picture this. It's election day. Voters are going to their respective polling stations and casting a vote for their preferred party or candidate. The information in these votes will somehow be added up by some electoral rule or system or procedure in order to determine how seats in an assembly are distributed. So this assembly could be a parliament or a House of Representatives, for instance. So as someone who was born and raised in the Philippines and currently lives in the Netherlands, I've experienced two vastly different electoral systems. So in the Philippines, when I cast my vote for the House of Representatives, I select a single candidate from a list, and that candidate will then be my vote for the second district of Quezon City. In the Netherlands, a Dutch person, regardless of where she's from, chooses a party from the same list as every other Dutch person. How do these votes then get added up? So all of the votes from candidates in the second district of Quezon City are added up, and the candidate with the most number of votes wins. So this is what is called the plurality rule. Note that this is different from the majority rule, where a winning candidate has to get over 50% of the votes. So in the Netherlands, the rule that they use is called proportional representation. How this works is that votes for each party are added up, and seats in parliament are distributed to each of these parties based on the proportion of the votes that they get during the elections. Another key difference to note between these two countries is the system of dividing the geographical territory into subunits, districting. So in the Philippines, I am a voter in the second district of Quezon City. And so we have 253 districts over the whole country. And the House of Representatives is composed of a single representative from each of those 253 districts. In the Netherlands, there are 150 members of parliament, and they all represent the Netherlands as a whole. So the Netherlands is one big district. Now, these two systems, while being the most common, certainly don't exhaust all of the systems that are being used today or that are even theoretically possible to use. And that is what we will get into in this presentation.
Okay, thank you, Rudy. Thank you for the video. So now to the main event of the evening, so to speak, our two main speakers who are with us from a distance, but will, I'm confident, be no less compelling for that. Our first speaker will be Eric Maskin, who won the 2007 Nobel Prize in Economics for laying the foundations of mechanism design theory, though he's made major contributions to game theory, contract theory, social choice theory, and political economy. He's currently Adams University professor and professor of economics and mathematics at Harvard University. After Professor Maskin, we will hear from Professor Amartya Sen, who was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in Economics in 1998, in his case for work in welfare economics. From 1971 to 1977, he was a professor of economics here at LSE and is now an honorary fellow of LSE. He's currently the Thomas W. Lamont University Professor and Professor of Economics and Philosophy at Harvard University. He has likewise made countless important contributions to economic and political theory in areas ranging from welfare economics to development economics to social choice theory, philosophical debates around equality and liberty. So we'll turn it over. Professor Maskin will speak first, followed then by Professor Sen. And then we'll hear from some commentators.
Hello, everyone. I'd like to talk about something that Rudy Farah brought up, which is the current electoral system, first past the post, plurality rule, and its major failings. Could I have the next slide, please? So here is a real life example from 2005. It's the UK general election results for Croydon Central. And I've got the vote totals for each of the candidates. And the conservative candidate, Andrew Pelling, ended up winning. But there's a problem with that. And we can see that on the next slide. Next slide, please. So as you see from the percentages, although the Tory candidate won, he won with only 40.8% of the vote. That is far short of a majority. Now you might say, well, that's still the most votes, but it's quite possible that there was another candidate, the Labour candidate, who was actually more popular. And to see that, let's look at the next slide. So as we've already discussed, as Rudy Farah discussed, Britain has this first-past-the-post system. Each voter votes for one candidate. The candidate with the most votes wins. What's wrong with that? Well, in Croydon, what was wrong with that is that a large fraction of voters, nearly 20%, could not express their preference between the Tory candidate and the Labour candidate. Those were the only candidates with a serious chance of winning because they chose to vote for other candidates. If they had been able to express their preference, then one of the serious candidates, Tory or Labour, would have had a majority. Next slide, please. And in fact, there's a very good chance that the Labour candidates would have won because by all indications, a large majority of the Liberal Democrat voters would have voted for Labour please stay on the previous slide. A large majority of the Liberal Democrat voters probably would have gone for Davies, the Labour MP, giving him the victory. So the Liberal Democrat candidate, Hargreaves, ended up changing the outcome of the Croydon election, even though he had no chance of winning himself. this seems a profoundly undemocratic election system where a candidate who has no chance of winning ends up determining which of the serious candidates wins. Now, in 2005, this peculiarity did not affect the overall election. Labor won anyway, but there have been some famous cases in UK history where this kind of perversity did change the overall outcome. And now let's have the next slide. A very famous example was back in 1983 when the Conservatives won a very large victory, 61% of the seats, but they got only 42% of the vote. Now, why did this happen? Well, the opposition was split between Labour and a new alliance between the SDP party and the Liberal Party. Collectively, Labour and SDP got 53% of the vote, but the alliance ended up spoiling things for Labour. They weren't going to win the election. They ended up getting only 3.5% of the seats, but in constituency after constituency, they took votes away from Labour and ended up allowing the Tory candidate to win. So the alliance most likely changed the outcome of that election. Next slide, please. And so the question is, can we do better than this? Can we devise an election system where we don't have these spoiler effects? And the answer is yes. Next slide. And one lesson to learn from the 2005 election is that the first-past-the-post system ignores critical information. As I was saying, the Labour candidate very likely would have defeated the Conservative in a head-to-head contest, but there was no the voting system in place could not take account of the fact that there were more people supporting Labour than the Conservative, because voters could only vote for one candidate. Next slide, please. So part of the solution is to allow voters to rank candidates. Yes, you should say who your favorite candidate is, but then you should have the opportunity of ranking the other candidates. So you might have a ranking such as Lib Dem first, Labour second, Tory third, UKIP fourth, something like that. And then the question is, well, what do we do with these rankings to determine the winner? Next slide. What I'd like to propose is a method that was propounded over 200 years ago by the Marquis de Condorcet. We might call it true majority rule, or we could call it Condorcet voting, in which voters submit rankings, as I've been suggesting, and then we elect the candidate who, according to the rankings, would beat each other candidate in a head-to-head contest. Next slide. So that means that if the Croydon voters break down into four groups, as indicated on the slide, there's 13% where Lib Dem is ranked first, 40% where Labour is ranked first, and so on. In this example, which is meant to guess at what might have happened had voters been able to actually do rankings in Croydon, in this example, Labour is the winner, because in a contest between the Labour candidate and the Conservative candidate, Labour wins. Notice that the second column has Labour favored over the Tory candidate, and also in the first column, Labor is ahead of the Conservatives. So that's 53%. And similarly, you can check that Labor defeats the Lib Dem candidates and Labor defeats the UKIP candidate. So Labor is the true majority winner under Condorcet voting. Next slide. But then we have to ask the question, once voters submit rankings, there are many systems other than true majority rule, other than Condorcet, that become possible. So why should we focus especially on majority rule? Next slide. One well-known alternative to majority rule, in fact, Rudy mentioned that this was actually tried out in the UK in a referendum in 2011, is alternative voting. In alternative voting, again, voters rank candidates. And if some candidate gets a majority of the first place votes, then she's elected immediately. But otherwise, that we eliminate the candidate with the fewest first place votes. That candidate's supporters have their second place choice moved into first, and then we continue the process until some candidate does have a majority. Now that's not a bad system. It's certainly a lot better than first past the post, but why am I arguing for majority rule? Next slide, please.
Hi. I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
So how do we answer the question, which of these two methods is better? Well, the way a voting theorist like me tries to answer a question like that is to first say, well, what properties do we want any good voting system to satisfy? What principles underlie a good democratic voting system? Next slide. One obvious principle is the consensus principle. That is, if everybody, if all voters agree that A is better than B, then we should not elect B. And not surprisingly, both true majority rule and alternative voting satisfy the consensus principle. Next slide. Another very basic principle in a democracy is that all voters should count equally. This is sometimes called the one voter, one vote principle. It's sometimes called the anonymity principle. It just says that who you are as a voter doesn't matter. Only the vote itself matters. That seems essential in a democracy. And once again, it's satisfied by both true majority rule and alternative voting. Next slide, please. Another very basic idea is neutrality, which says that just as we want to treat all voters equally, we want to treat all candidates equally. That is, we shouldn't, for example, give a special privilege, a special leg up to an incumbent. All candidates are treated on an equal basis. And once again, true majority rule and alternative voting satisfy this principle. Next slide, please. But now we come to the issue that I began my talk with, which is the issue of spoilers. We would like to avoid a situation in which A and B are the serious candidates, but which of them wins depends on whether candidate C, who has no chance of winning, stands or not. The no spoilers condition says that it shouldn't matter for which of A and B wins, which one of them wins, whether candidate C is in the running or not. Now, notice that true majority rule satisfies this principle, because in true majority rule, we always compare two candidates at a time. So if the candidates are A, B, and C, and A is the true majority winner, that means A beats B, and A also beats C, clearly it doesn't matter whether C stands or not, A will still beat B. However, alternative voting, the proposal considered in the referendum of 2011 violates this no spoilers condition. Let's see the next slide. Here's an example in which if there are three candidates, Lib Dem, Labour, and Tory, if they all stand, then the Tory candidate wins. Now, none of those three candidates gets a majority of first place votes. And so according to the rules of alternative voting, we drop the candidate who has the fewest first place votes. That's Labour. Labour has 13 plus 12%. That's the 25%. So Labour gets dropped. And then Labour supporters' second place choices move into first. But now the Tory candidates will be ranked first 52% of the time, 12% from the Labour supporters and 40% from the Tory supporters. The Tory candidate will win if all three candidates are standing. But if it's only a race between Labour and Conservative, Labour wins. In other words, the Lib Dem candidate is a spoiler in this example. Next slide, please. You can see that according to the principles that I've been investigating, true majority rule is now ahead of alternative voting. All three of the first principles, consensus, anonymity, and neutrality, are satisfied by both voting systems, but only majority rule satisfies the no spoiler condition. However, it has to be pointed out, and Condorcet himself pointed this out, that there's a possible problem with majority rule, and that can be illustrated on the next slide. There might actually not be a candidate that beats each other candidate in a head-to-head contest. Next slide, please. Notice that in this example, the Labour candidate beats the Tory by a majority. The Tory candidate beats the Lib Dem by a majority, but the Lib Dem beats Labour by a majority. In other words, the three candidates go round and round, and there's no single candidate who beats the other two by majorities. This is called a Condorcet cycle, and it says that majority rule violates a principle of decisiveness. Decisiveness says that there should always exist a clear-cut winner. Alternative voting satisfies decisiveness because we keep eliminating candidates until some candidate gets a majority. But as we see from this example, Condorcet voting, majority rule, violates decisiveness. Next slide. So true majority rule satisfies four out of the five principles. Alternative voting satisfies four out of the five principles, not the same ones. The next question is, well, is there some voting system that satisfies all five? Consensus, anonymity, neutrality, no spoilers, decisiveness. Next slide, please. Unfortunately, the answer to that question is no, and this was settled in a famous result by Kenneth Arrow. We now call it the Arrow impossibility theorem. There is no voting method that satisfies all five principles. Next slide, please. But I would like to argue that Arrow's theorem is too negative. It's too pessimistic because it requires that an election method work no matter rankings, no matter what preferences voters might turn out to have. But in practice, some rankings are really quite unlikely. Next slide, please. So in the 2005 election, for example, in those days, the Lib Dems really were on the they were furthest to the left, ideologically speaking. The UKIP party was clearly furthest to the right, and Labour and Conservative were in between. In an election like that, it's very unlikely that many Tory voters would put the Lib Dem candidate ahead of Labour. But in order to get the sort of cycling effect that we were talking about a few minutes ago, it's important that a lot of Tory voters put Lib Dem ahead of Labour. That just doesn't seem plausible in practice. And in fact, if we rule out that possibility, then actually majority rule is decisive. So practically speaking, majority rule turns out to be decisive. Next slide, please. And that suggests that we should define a voting rule. We should say that a voting rule works well for a limited class of preferences, the preferences which are actually likely to arise in practice, if it satisfies the five principles when voters' rankings are actually drawn from this limited, restricted class of rankings, the rankings that we expect will occur in reality. So, for example, true majority rule works if voters are inclined to vote ideologically. And now we get to the final slide, which is the theoretical result. So this can be called a domination theory. It says that if you have some voting method, any voting method, that works well for a particular class of rankings in the sense that it satisfies the five principles for those rankings, then it turns out that true majority rule must also work well for that same class. And furthermore, there will exist some other class of rankings where majority rule works well, but the other voting method does not. A simple way to put it is that majority rule works well more often than any other method. And this is the formal sense in which majority rule really is the best voting method in practice. Now, this is not to say that alternative voting is a bad idea. It's certainly much better than first past the post, but Condorcet voting, majority rule, really is the gold standard. And let me stop there. Thank you.
The presentation was meant to be called Voting and Democracy, and I begin by thanking Maurice Sall and Rudy Fire for arranging it and thanking them all and saying that democracy was a glorious subject. Democracy is an important part of the subject of social choice theory, a discipline which presents interesting problems, some of which have not yet been adequately explored. One of them concerns the method of vote counting, on which Eric Maskin has just spoken. I had some remark on that, but I'll skip that. But among the particular problem, which I think requires more work, concerns Arrow's impossibility theorem, which was established by Arrow in 1950, and there are various contribution, many hundred that have followed from Arrow's pioneering departure, showing the impossibility of aggregating individual preferences into what he was concerned with, namely a collectively rational social choice arrangement. In particular, the idea of a social preference that is on the basis of the individual preferences you try to arrive at comparison between the alternative for the society and collective rationality which Arrow imposed, suggests that it should have some system. First of all, the idea of social preference can be sustained, and that social preference should be transitive in Arrow's presentation. Now, that raised immediate questions, despite the concession that everyone had that Arrow's theorem was a great mathematical result. The question is, what's the relevance of it in the context of actual politics? Many things have been written on voting theory, but the one I want to concentrate on is that whether the voting theory generates collective rationality or not may turn out to be only a part of the answer, a part of the investigation, because even if the voting system worked perfectly, you will not be able to be sure that you have a democracy, because it requires many other conditions, in particular the possibility of public free thinking, free expression, free discussion. I think Rudy Fire in his introductory remark commented on that. The idea of collective rationality was questioned strongly in the literature, in particular by the public choice school led by James Buchanan, who thought that unlike individuals, society cannot be taken to have an integrated personality, so why demand collective rationality? And if you don't demand it, then the Arrow impossibility theorem does not work. And therefore, we shouldn't worry too much about that. Now, what I wanted to say, and I'm going to skip some discussion of Tocqueville and others, this is not right in the sense that while Arrow did impose collective rationality to get to his impossibility, he did not mathematically need to do that in the sense that we could drop the condition of collective rationality altogether and still get the same impossibility result. This doesn't mean that Buchanan's discussion of collective rationality is worthless. Far from it. It was a very good discussion. But it turns out that even without collective rationality being imposed, that is the idea that society has a preference on the basis of individual preferences, and that preference is transitive. All these conditions, even the very idea of social preference, can be dropped. And this is important to bear in mind because it focuses on the nature of public discussion and the openness of it. The democracy is under attack. I think Rudy commented on that. And we have to bear in mind that we live in a world where democracy needs defense. But even if the voting system has problems, the problems don't arise primarily, I believe, from collective rationality being imposed. Now, there's some mathematical results here, which I presented in the 1990s in two presentations. One was my presidential address to the Economic Society, and then another was my presidential address to the American Economic Association, respectively published in Econometrica and American Economic Review, Econometrica in 93 and American Economic Review in 95, which shows that collective rationality could be entirely dropped. Now, I'm not going to try to present the proof here. I must say, very afraid of how presentations involving slides can work, quite aside from the communicability of mathematical results. So I won't go into that. Those who are interested in the proof can look up the Econometrica or Economic Review. What happens is that many cases you could have a good voting system, but even a perfect voting system, in many ways, to the extent perfection is possible, but in this area. But if you don't have public reasoning, it doesn't produce democratic results. Many dictators survive by not changing the voting system, but preventing information being circulated and discussions being freely done. So free speech and free discussion become very central, and together we might call that collective rationality or collective reasoning, which requires a freedom of being able to discuss things with each other. If you think about the erstwhile dictatorial states, or even today, whether it's North Korea, or many countries in the Middle East, you would have the same fear coming from a public discussion being stifled. Now, the history of democracy looks very different if you take a voting-centered view of democracy rather than a collective rationality understanding of democracy, which requires public discussion. When people say that there was democracy is a Western gift to the world, there's some truth in that, in the sense that it's in ancient Greece, and followed that in Rome. There were very good discussions on collective rationality problem. Both voting systems and the need for open public discussions. But the imitation of that did not come in the West so much, not only among the Goths and Visigoths of Europe, but nor in the areas which is now Germany or Britain or France. In contrast, some of the contemporary cities in Western and Southern Asia, particularly in Bactria, Iran, and also India, incorporated elements of democracy in municipal governance in centuries following the flowering of Athenian democracies. For example, in Iran, the city of Susa or Shushan had an elected council We are talking about the 4th century and BC, well, not quite yet, sorry, 4th and following Alexander, who were the great purveyor of Greek questions. But some of the answers came in Iran and Bactria, and also to some extent India. And if you judge what happened there, they were voting, but public reasoning went with it. While Athens and Rome did have very much to encourage public discussion, the championing of public discussion came from other sources, particularly from Buddhist sources. Buddha himself was very keen on public discussion. And the Buddhist Council, which had international meetings at some places, mostly initially in India in the 6th century BC, and then 5th century and the 3rd century BC, sought the major Buddhist Council that Emperor Ashoka arranged in what is now Patna. And he also tried to have something like what in the 19th century came to be called Robert's Rules of Order, which are about how to conduct discussion, allowing others to speak, listening to them, and having rules of public discussion. Now, we have to also examine the history of the Middle East, since it becomes such a contentious area, and there are conflicts going on and violation of democratic practice in many places. But we have to bear in mind that this is not the way of looking at Arab civilization at the time of its flowering. At one stage, Cordoba, in Spain, but under Muslim kingdom, was thought to be the most civilized place in the world. It had a long history of integrating Jews as secure members of social community along with the Arab. The polity of Cordoba in the 10th century, which was often taken to be the most civilized place in the world, was governed jointly by Caliph Abd al-Rahman III, a devout Muslim, and his Jewish vizier, Hasdai ibn Shafut. So this is a joint Arab-Jewish governance, which is worth remembering today with the war that's taking place in Palestine, Lebanon, and the rest of the Middle East. When in the 1590s, the great Mughal emperor, Akbar, was making his pronouncement in India on the need for religious and political toleration, and when he was busy arranging organized dialogue between members of different faiths, Hindus, Muslims, Christians, Parsis, Jains, Jews, and even, it must be noted, atheists, which he included. The Inquisition at that very time when he was doing that, the Inquisitions were still very active in Europe. Giordano Bruno was burned at the stake in Rome for heresy in 1690, exactly at the time when Akbar was lecturing in Agra in India on the need for toleration and cooperation between different religious communities. I mention here, since I do come from India, that India did try to initiate a democratic secular democracy in the first poor country to try that, and had some success, but this has declined quite sharply, like in the rest of the world. And the decline is not so much in the system of voting, or a bit reflected there, but much more in preventing public discussion and opening up of the media and other ways of talking to each other. So I conclude public reasoning about epistemological and ethical questions, particularly about social justice and welfare, and not just voting, is crucial for democracy. And this recognition is important for governance today, namely how to have democracy and how to see it as more than a system of voting. But it's also important for understanding global history of democracy in particular, and as a result, the idea of democracy has an ancestry of which we can be proud, and we can join in the protest about the trifling of a global tradition and not just a Western practice that was somehow got associated with the idea of democracy. So I'll stop there.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events Podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.